Today, the Democratic Unionist Party in Northern Ireland backed Brexit. But could that decision to leave the EU now lead to the party's downfall? Rory, you've been in Northern Ireland for the last couple of weeks reporting on what feels like quite a big moment in the post-Brexit story. You went to a unionist march recently. Tell me about that.
It was very loud and very colourful, as loyalist marches in the summer's marching season always are. There's about 3,000 people gathered at the top of the Shankill Road in West Belfast. It was people of all ages, including families, and they marched down behind costumed marching bands, including guys with these huge lambeg drums. And if you've never heard one, well, you could hear it almost on the other side of the Irish Sea. It's pretty loud. And this is a familiar sight every summer in Northern Ireland. But this year, the difference is the main banner that people were marching behind, instead of being King William or references to battles from the 18th century, it was to get rid of the Northern Ireland Protocol. And it was remarkable. There was, in fact, big banners saying, "Protect the Northern Ireland peace process, trigger Article 16. This was like the size of the length of a bus, this banner carried by four women. And behind it are marching 3,000 very angry people.
Article 16 sounds like quite a technical thing to have on a banner. What does this boil down to? What were the people you spoke to most angry about?
The Irish Sea border is the way it would be put, and that is now spilling over into a wave of resentment against the Democratic Unionist Party because their fingerprints are all over it, and so they're carrying the blame for this.
The problems for the DUP that The Guardian's Ireland correspondent Rory Carroll is describing arguably began exactly 5 years ago, on June the 23rd, 2016, in a decision they backed. Brexit has sent shockwaves through Northern Irish politics and brought crisis to its largest unionist party. Tomorrow, Sir Geoffrey Donaldson will become the DUP's third leader in just 4 weeks, taking over as a new trade border down the Irish Sea has triggered what is being described as sausage wars. In a week that marks 100 years since the formation of a parliament in Northern Ireland, unionists feel under attack.
The narrative they tell is that since the Good Friday Agreement of 1998, they have been on the receiving end of a relentless campaign by the other side, meaning Sinn Féin and Republicans and Irish nationalists, to unpick their Britishness and to somehow manoeuvre Northern Ireland into a united Ireland. And they feel that the other side is winning.
From The Guardian, I'm Anoushka Astana. Today in Focus, has Brexit driven Northern Ireland's largest unionist party to the brink of collapse? Rory, the DUP are the leading unionist party in Northern Ireland and they share control on the Stormont Assembly. The past few months have been tumultuous for them. And as you've just described it, it seems that a lot of it stems from Brexit. They backed Brexit right from the start, didn't they? Why was that?
They did because there's always been a Eurosceptic streak within unionism, a nostalgic longing for Britain standing alone and its glory days, as they would see it, be it the Elizabethan era or World War II. And that is also fused with an alliance in Westminster between Democratic Unionist MPs, some of them, and the Brexiteers of the Conservative Party. They made common cause with them because in an ideological sense, they felt that this was a good thing. Now, more widely, the Democratic Unionist Party didn't really think deeply about Brexit. They didn't think through strategically what the implications for Northern Ireland, even though the fact that they were warned, I mean, the likes of Tony Blair, John Major warned before the referendum that this would have major destabilisation effects on Northern Ireland. And simply they just tuned that out, either because the ideologues in the party were so committed to the Brexit dream or else the others just didn't kind of take the concerns seriously. And so they just let it sail through. And there was an expectation, I think, that probably the referendum would be defeated anyway, so that they could score easy points with their grassroots who dislike Brussels without paying any political price for it.
So in a way, the idea of Brexit, rather than the reality, represented an even tighter union.
Yes, because then they would be wedded into this proud, new, standing alone UK, which in some sense would further distance themselves from Ireland and by extension the rest of the European Union. So they felt that it would be Britain on steroids and that they would be part of that.
And obviously it did happen. They were wrong if they thought that it was going to be lost. And they, the DUP, became absolutely critical in British politics in its aftermath, propping up Theresa May's government after the 2017 election.
Today, we have reached an agreement with the Conservative Party on support for government in Parliament. This agreement will operate to deliver a stable government in the United Kingdom's national interest at this vital time.
I mean, many would say Theresa May bent over backwards to maintain the integrity of the United Kingdom by agreeing to a softer form of Brexit. Why didn't they back her?
Firstly, they didn't like Theresa May. She never kind of won their trust, never charmed them. And when Theresa May did come up with a compromise which tried to kind of protect Northern Ireland or at least minimise the impact on Northern Ireland of any Brexit deal, even those tweaks or slight distinctions in how Northern Ireland would be treated were too much for the DUP. They said, no, you will be treating us somewhat differently than the rest of the UK. We can't accept this. So that was why they rejected her deals and helped sink Theresa May and her vision of Brexit.
Did they trust Boris Johnson to protect their interests?
This is a fascinating psychological study, whether the DUP trusted Boris Johnson. Certainly they were charmed by him, sufficiently so to invite him to address their party conference at the end of 2018. And it was their leader, Arlene Foster, who invited Johnson over. They passed me by and they were arm in arm, literally, on his way to make this speech.
Literally?
Yes, he had his arm in a slightly kind of shambly, shambly way, walking through the crowd on the way to the main auditorium. He, by then, had quit as foreign minister and was angling for the top job in Downing Street.
Or whatever. If we wanted to vary our regulation, then we would have to leave Northern Ireland behind as an economic semi-colony of the EU.
So what he was saying was that Northern Ireland, under Theresa May's proposed deal, was going to be treated differently and that this was unacceptable. No British Prime Minister, least of all a Conservative one, could accept such an affront to British sovereignty and the Union. And he got a storming ovation, proceeded to get the top job, his paths to Downing Street smoothed by the DUP. And of course, we all know how the story then took a turn, which was that he then did a deal which, from the DUP's perspective, was even worse, in which Northern Ireland was completely off the trading arrangements that were negotiated just for Great Britain. And so in the end, the DUP shot themselves in both feet with a shotgun by helping Boris Johnson into power.
You know, as you say, the rhetoric from Boris Johnson, but also from the DUP, that there could be a hard Brexit without any border within the UK, without that border down the Irish Sea, turned out to be fiction. And the result was, in fact, a Northern Ireland protocol. Can you explain what was agreed and what it meant to unionists?
Boris Johnson got his hard Brexit by taking Great Britain out of the common market and customs union. And that delivered on the promise to the arch Brexiteers. So they were happy. The price for that was that Northern Ireland had to be kind of frozen out from this and that Northern Ireland would have to be kept within the de facto customs union and single market. And this, of course, is because the Dublin government and the European Union Commission said that at some point there has to be a border somewhere and it's not going to be on the island of Ireland for economic and political reasons. And so Boris Johnson, to get his oven-ready deal out of the oven, meant that that border then would have to be plonked in the Irish Sea so that it would be affecting goods travelling from GB, Great Britain, over to Northern Ireland. And that is where the regulatory checks would take place, which sounds very kind of arcane thing, but that drilled right into the core of the unionist psyche and their fear of betrayal and their insecurity about their place in the UK.
Lisa O'Carroll, you're The Guardian's Brexit correspondent and you've been following the aftermath of the referendum for years and Irish politics for even longer. We've been hearing a lot lately about the so-called sausage wars.
8 a.m, eye to eye for a Brexit breakfast time meeting and one thing on the menu.
Which are a bitter dispute over what chilled meats can be sent into Northern Ireland. How did we get here?
Well, under the Northern Ireland Protocol, Northern Ireland observes EU rules on food and agricultural products, whether it's tractors or meat. So in effect, you can imagine that Belfast is operating similarly to a city or a town that borders with Russia or another EU third country border. So all the same checks apply. In an agreement that the UK reached with Brussels in December, they agreed that over 6 months, checks would be phased in. So initially, we had checks on supermarket foods and we had some grace periods for the larger supermarket chains. And there was a separate grace period for chilled meats, which includes sausages and minced meat. And that is due to expire on the 30th of June. And that is where the sausage war and that term arises from, because unless there is a further agreement, basically sausages going from GB to Northern Ireland, there will be a complete ban, something that the Environment Secretary here, George Eustace, has called bonkers.
But didn't they foresee this? Wasn't it part of the original deal?
Absolutely. And Maros Sefcovic, the European Commission Vice President, who is effectively the Brexit minister in the Commission, was in London last week and did the first press conference that we've been at face-to-face for 14 months. And you could see over the hour the deep frustration that the EU had.
We are at the crossroads in our relationship with the UK. Trust, which should be at the heart of every partnership, needs to be restored.
He explained that back in March 2020, when Michael Gove was the main interlocutor on the Brexit deal, that he had pressed him again and again about these arrangements and said, are you sure you are OK with this? And he said the response from the UK was, yes, we have an open book. We will share with you how we are evolving the implementation roadmap, if you like. And remember, in this context, the UK had an opportunity to avail of a 2-year transition period and had said no. So we had a cliff edge in Northern Ireland from January the 1st. But what happened then was there was a shift in personnel on the UK side. Michael Gove left his position as the main Brexit person in the cabinet and he was replaced by Lord Frost. And within a week of Lord Frost assuming this new position, he pulled the chain on the protocol.
And what does pulling the chain on the protocol mean?
It means that the UK would not comply with the grace period on sausage sales and would continue to allow British sausages be sold in Northern Ireland after the 30th of June.
And when you say the UK is just going to unilaterally send sausages into Northern Ireland, is no one else policing that border down the Irish Sea? Is it up to Britain to make sure that that border operates?
Yes, and I guess what you could say is that all the power is on the UK side because very controversially, and also as part of this Northern Ireland Protocol, the EU for the first time agreed to allow a third country, the UK, to be the border force in Belfast and Larne and other ports. So it's UK officials who are doing the checks. And the EU's complaint is that they are not getting data from the ports in Belfast.
There were shortages at first, but I'm told that you can get your sausages now in Northern Ireland. They just may not come from Great Britain. In terms of solving this, the UK is firm, as it always has been, that it will not align completely with EU rules in this area. But are there alternatives being discussed?
What it looks like they are likely to accept is something along the lines of the deal that New Zealand has with Australia, which would allow stuff like red meat, poultry meat, fish products to go in with no checks. And then the chilled meat, the sausage ban would still exist. But we think they'll get around that by agreeing a trusted trader scheme, which would mean that the EU would essentially trust the likes of Marks and Spencer or Sainsbury's or other big sausage producers to comply with EU rules. And therefore, those products could be sold easily with no checks in Northern Ireland.
OK, as we record this, it's been reported in Ireland that the EU is expected to grant the UK an extension of 3 months to the chilled meats grace period to try to agree a solution like what you've described. But essentially, what you're describing is that the Northern Ireland Protocol has fundamentally changed Northern Ireland's position with regards to Great Britain and the EU. And that has already changed trade flows from either side into Northern Ireland, hasn't it?
Yeah, what is interesting in the first 6 months is that the trade between the Republic of Ireland and Northern Ireland has doubled. What we've got to remember is that British goods going into the Republic of Ireland are subject to exactly the same checks as British goods going into Northern Ireland. So that has meant that the supply chain on fresh food in Ireland has changed. So Ireland is replacing GB supplies with Northern Ireland supplies and ditto with the North-South supply chain. So the single market of the island of Ireland is booming.
And to some extent, people could argue that this isn't about identity, it's about trade flows. But it really matters, doesn't it, to the unionist community in Northern Ireland?
Yeah, you're absolutely right. The EU and some in Northern Ireland constantly argue that this is a technical process that could be solved behind the scenes. However, for unionist and loyalist communities, this is a much, much deeper problem. They argue that anything that weakens their relationship with London, even if it's only a trade weakening, fuels fears over the possibility of a united Ireland, which is something obviously they would be deeply opposed to.
Rory, we've just heard from Lisa about how the so-called sausage wars feel like everything the DUP feared beginning to take shape. To what extent did all of that fallout over the Brexit deal pile pressure on DUP leader at the time, Arlene Foster?
Brexit and specifically the Northern Ireland Protocol has been a toxic whirlwind that's been buffeting the DUP and especially Arlene Foster's leadership of the last couple of years. The sense that Northern Ireland was going to be treated differently from the rest of the UK was the nightmare scenario. And even worse for the DUP was that their strategy, or lack of strategy really, had so backfired that their fingerprints, their DNA was all over this deal, which is considered a dagger in the heart of unionism. And so this made Arlene Foster's position extremely difficult. By start of 2021, she was already a weak leader. There's a sense that she wasn't listening. But then when the protocol kicked in January, that made her position really destabilized because initially she tried to sell the protocol. I mean, she went along with the idea that actually this could be a good thing for Northern Ireland, that it could have access to the British market, access to the EU, and it would have, in the jargon of Brexit, the best of both worlds. And many people would agree with her that, in fact, this is the case. We'd seldom hear their voices because they're not out in the streets protesting. So she tried to go with that. But very, very quickly, the hardliners in her party said, no way, the protocol is an assault on our identity. And so then she had to row back extremely quickly and try to launch this campaign saying, OK, now the DUP is going to lead the campaign against the protocol. But that never had a ring of authenticity or credibility that Arlene Foster would now lead a campaign against it. And so in April, there was a coup led by Edwin Poots, the agriculture minister at Stormont. And in the space of basically 24 hours, they got most of the assembly members and the MPs, it seems, in Westminster to sign letters saying, de facto, we've lost confidence in Arlene Foster. It was considered very brutal, but at the same time, it was deemed she was reaping the whirlwind off her own misjudgments. And there's a sense that the DUP did need a clean slate. The problem was that the new leader, Edwin Poots, turned out to be even worse than Arlene Foster.
Why? Tell me what happened. What was Poots offering that was different to Foster? And what happened?
Right there was one of the problems. Poots, in a sense, wasn't offering anything substantially different from Arlene Foster, because both were saying, we've got to get rid of the protocol, or we've got to amend it. But Poots seemed to be saying, but I'll do it better. And Poots was the victor. He emerged in a very narrow contest over Geoffrey Donaldson in May.
And so what happened to Poots?
Well, Edwin Poots had a honeymoon that lasted about 5 seconds. He announced that he was going to listen to the party that had felt ignored and belittled by their own leadership, and that he's going to be a new style of leader. And then suddenly, after just 21 days after he was ratified as leader, last week he made an appalling blunder when there was a dispute in the Stormont Assembly over an Irish Language Act, which in theory had nothing to do with the protocol. Sinn Féin had been long promised legislation to elevate the status of the Irish language. And the DUP had agreed to this, as all the other parties had, in a deal several years ago. But Brexit had made this toxic because unionists and DUP people felt that Sinn Féin had already won a huge victory by having the Brexit border placed in the Irish Sea rather than on the border with the Republic of Ireland. And they felt that having an Irish Language Act on top of that was just adding insult to injury. But Poots was so anxious to get his deal over the line. He made a deal brokered by the British government to basically agree that the legislation would happen, but without consulting his colleagues. Now, this was the most extraordinary part of this. When there was a party meeting the next morning to discuss it, and people saying, hang on, what's this happened here? We're not sure about this. He actually walked out while Sammy Wilson, the MP, was speaking, and went into the Assembly chamber and confirmed the deal and his choice for First Minister, Paul Given.
And with Paul in the leadership of the First Minister's office, I believe we will win for unionism, but not just unionism. We'll win for everyone.
And so this meant that he just kind of completely shredded his authority within the party. And within hours, he was summoned to party headquarters and told that he would have to walk the plank, that there's no way he could continue as leader. And so a party that had three leaders over 50 years now lost its fourth leader in the space of 21 days. As some people remarked, I mean, that's even less time than the shelf life of the missing sausages on shelves.
And obviously, political watchers are finding this ridiculous. Have you spoken to ordinary voters in Northern Ireland? What are they making of all of this?
When I stop in the street doing a Vox Pop, for instance, and say, oh, I want to talk to you, ask you, what do you think about the latest politics? And there's one woman and she's running, no, I can't bear it. And she just sprinted off. And others sigh, roll their eyes, and they're angry. Now, especially, for example, in the case of loyalists who are ultra unionists and feel that their British identity matters so much to them, they're the ones who are absolutely appalled by the DUP. And what's dangerous about that is they feel that they don't really have a representation now.
Okay, so the DUP is facing a huge challenge. And tomorrow, its new leader, Sir Geoffrey Donaldson, who is running unopposed, will be crowned. He actually opposed the Good Friday Agreement, but has in recent years become a relatively moderate figure within the party. But obviously, he's taking over a party that has faced quite a severe crisis. What has all of that meant for the DUP electorally? What is likely to happen to them if there were an election?
Opinion polls over the past year have suggested that the DP will be annihilated, that they would go from being the biggest party in the Stormont Assembly to being the second, third, possibly even the fourth party. Certainly with Sinn Féin emerging as the biggest party and the DUP possibly being behind the Alliance and maybe even the Ulster Unionist Party, which would be a calamitous collapse for the party. So there is a lot of nervousness on that score. So Donaldson does want to avert an early election to give the party time to recover. But at the same time, he also needs to navigate the fact that so many people in the party are so angry that they feel that if the price of avoiding election is being reasonable and making compromises in Stormont, as power sharing requires, well, that's only going to dig the DUP into an even deeper hole.
Coming up, more woes for unionists as senior politicians in the Republic raise the prospect of a united Ireland. Rory, when we last spoke in April, there were riots in Belfast and there was serious concern about the re-emergence of violence, obviously with some echoes of the past.
The violence began on the Loyalist Shankill Road, where protesters had gathered. A bus was hijacked and set on fire. Then, across the Peace Wall in the Springfield Road area, Republican youths rioted.
How tense is the situation right now? What are you hearing?
It's worrying, because when you have these threats, which are new, I mean, these are from shadowy groups. Some of them pop up on Facebook and they're saying that we need resistance. There's a woman the other day at a rally, was interviewed on Sky, and she said, I'm willing to lay down my life to defeat the protocol. And she was a very kind of middle class, beautifully dressed woman. And some of the loyalists I spoke to, representatives in Mid-Ulster, they said, we didn't fill the graveyards during the Troubles for this. And they said all of the conversations they had leading up to the ceasefires in 1994, those type of conversations were now happening, except in reverse. And the implication being that they're heading back maybe towards some form of violence. And when I asked them, well, who do you target? The blame for Brexit? I mean, you kind of detarget the DUP, you target Boris Johnson, Brussels, Dublin. The answer was north-south trade, warehouses, roads, transport, logistics, something like that, as a protest against the fact that trade has been redirected from east-west across the Irish Sea now to north-south. And they feel economically this is kind of shunting them down towards a united Ireland. Now, you need a big health warning on this, that a lot of this could be bluster. I mean, we haven't really seen any, apart from brief disturbances on the street in April over Easter, there's not been violence yet. So this could all yet become vaporous and disappear into the autumn air after the summer's passed. But alternatively, it could become real, because this is a community that in many ways does feel belittled, ignored, betrayed, and they feel that they don't have political representation. So in a place like Northern Ireland, that's not good.
And what about Republicans? Do they see the difficulties facing unionists as an opportunity?
Absolutely. They've been enjoying the DUP's meltdown in lieu of Hollywood blockbusters. Who needs Spielberg when you got the DUP? But also, Sinn Féin sees the strategic opportunity here to push forward on a United Ireland agenda. And also on their side, demographically, things are changing. This year, there's a census which may show for the first time in Northern Ireland's 100-year history that Catholics now outnumber Protestants. And meantime, in the south of Ireland, Sinn Féin are ascendant. I mean, they're the biggest opposition party. They're surging in the polls, and they increasingly do look like a government in waiting in the south of Ireland. So that all adds up from a Republican point of view as a sense of historical momentum building behind you.
And within that, we had this really extraordinary speech by Leo Varadkar, the Deputy Prime Minister in the Republic, saying that they should be proud to say unification is something that is aspired towards.
Delegates, I believe in the unification of our island, and I believe it can happen in my lifetime. It means the unification of the people of our island, as well as the territory of Ireland, and is a legitimate political aspiration.
He insisted he wasn't talking about the annexation of Northern Ireland, but something that it was possible to work towards. But is it a prospect that's actually realistic in any way?
Realistically, I don't see any prospect of a referendum on United Ireland in the short term. If and when there is a referendum, there's absolutely no guarantee it will pass, because most people in Northern Ireland still consistently tell pollsters that they would vote against it if asked. They like the NHS. And Sinn Féin just in Northern Ireland really riles people the wrong way. In a sense, they rally people against the idea of United Ireland, because many still feel that they glorify the IRA's violence during the Troubles. And economic issues, what could the south of Ireland afford this? And meantime, in a kind of medium term sense, Sinn Féin's main goal is not United Ireland, it's to get into government in the south of Ireland. And they want to be seen as a mainstream party that's not going to risk violence in the north, because that could affect their vote in the south. That's why Irish unity is certainly not imminent, certainly not inevitable. And I mean, there's so many obstacles to actually seeing it ever happen.
Rory, you've talked us through this dramatic moment in Northern Ireland's history and the pressure Brexit has put on unionism. Does what's happening feel like it will have reverberations for a long time to come?
History never leaves Northern Ireland alone, and we have a surfeit of it here. This week is the 100th anniversary of the foundation of the Stormont Parliament. The Loyalist marching season is gearing up. We're going to see banners commemorating battles from the 17th, 18th centuries. Yet, for Loyalists, the concern now is that we're at a new historical turning point, and from their perspective, not a good one. Because between demographics, the European Union kind of heft, the betrayal of a treacherous prime minister in Downing Street, as they would see it, the connivance of these plotting Irish nationalists in the Dublin government, and the sense of friendlessness, the sense that hundreds of years ago when King Billy was fighting in Ireland, that loyalism was a proud force with allies across the water, and that now is no longer the case. And that now, at this historical point, if they're to try to stop the tide of history surging a certain way, that they need to do something quick and something dramatic to stop it.
Rory Carroll, thank you very much.
Thank you, Anushka.
That was Rory Carroll and Lisa O'Carroll. Do read all of their brilliant reporting at theguardian.com. Now, if you haven't listened to The Guardian's new podcast, Comfort Eating with Grace Dent, you have to do so. It is so brilliant. I was listening to her latest episode with Nish Kumar this week and was laughing out loud. It was good to hear that he likes spooning hummus out of the tub, like me. Last week was Russell T Davies, and that was also exceptional. Do download it wherever you listen to your podcasts. Before I go, I wanted to let you know about one other thing, a very special audiovisual project that The Guardian has been involved in recently. It's called Auditorial, and it is an innovative experiment from The Guardian, Google, and the Royal National Institute of Blind People, the RNIB. It's all about trying to showcase the possibilities of accessible stories for blind and low vision audiences, with the platform actually adapting to suit the reader. It brings to life an audio-led piece called The Silent Spring, which explores the devastating effects of the climate crisis on the sounds of the natural world. It's actually centred around Bernie Krause, who was originally featured in our own Science Weekly and Today in Focus podcasts in 2018. Do check it out at g.co/auditorial. That's it for today. This episode was produced by Courtney Youssef. Sound design was by Sami El Enani. The executive producers are Archie Bland and Phil Maynard. I hope you have a great weekend. We'll be back on Monday.